I'm Binder Sudgen, and this is Lady at the Ledge. Okay, so that was me dabbling in stand-up comedy. Whether you think it's funny or not, I wanted to bring up casual racism and expose it for being both rampant and hurtful. Casual racism isn't a joke, though, and it's often more insidious and hurtful than overt racism because it feels harder to call out. Another term I've recently learned is racial gaslighting. This is where someone calls people out for not recognizing how their actions, their behavior, or their words hurt, and instead of a conversation, is accused of being a bully, a liar, or worse. I'm reflecting on all this as we witness a rise in anti-Asian racism, up by more than 700% in Vancouver in 2020 alone. For many of us, the shootings in Atlanta, which claimed the lives of six Asian women and were initially said to be the result of a sex addiction and someone's bad day, were a wake-up call. For one woman, it was a call to action. My guest is a former journalist who runs a video production agency, Eileen Park Robertson. She's been speaking out about anti-Asian hate in Vancouver, something she's also experienced.
Atlanta changed everything. We have been suppressing our rage as Asian women for decades, just absorbing the poison of the everyday microaggressions that we've been facing. But after seeing our own killed in Atlanta, because of our silence, because of the world's silence, because we haven't had enough exposure on the everyday casual racist attitudes against Asian women, that happened and we've had enough. And when I fully started understanding the historical and current fetishization and hypersexualization of Asian women, I just couldn't be silent anymore.
Did you find, as you know, you're a former journalist, as a journalist, did you find it hard to speak out about race issues?
Yes, this is deeply personal. As a journalist, it's your job to focus on the stories of other people and making sure you do your due diligence in telling their stories right, accurately, objectively. And then when the tables turn and it's your story and your experience, it's deeply uncomfortable and it's really vulnerable. We're talking about a subject that has historically been shoved under the rug because it's uncomfortable. It's triggering for a lot of women because no woman that I know would want to be associated with being fetishized. And that was, so I just went right there. I went, okay, let's just blow the lid off of this thing and just start talking about it because no one is talking about it. But Atlanta, after Atlanta, all these women started coming forward, these incredible women who have shared their own experiences with being hypersexualized and fetishized. And they gave me the language to understand what I was experiencing. And I want to make this distinction because it's important. I'm not talking about sexuality in terms of female empowerment. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking very specifically about hypersexualization and fetishization being used to oppress and commodify Asian women.
That's where it becomes problematic, is when you don't own your sexuality, when somebody else is kind of putting it on you.
That right there. Exactly.
Now, at the same time as Atlanta, you were actually dealing with your own backlash, I don't even know what to call it, because of the publication in Vogue.
By the way, I do want to mention this. I resist the idea that I was a victim to Asian hate. And the language around that is important because that further puts Asian women in this category of we're weak, we're victimized, we're, you know, we don't know how to stand up for ourselves. And I don't have an alternative for that. I really don't, but victim just, the language of victim is very problematic to me, but that's a whole nother thing.
No, so, good point, yeah.
Yeah, so when news of our marriage came out, it was just about 24 hours after 8 people died in Atlanta, and then 6 of them Asian women, and then 4 of them Korean women. And we just started learning that the killer was saying that he wasn't motivated by hate. He was motivated by a sex addiction. So let's deconstruct that for a moment, because that's what everyone ran with. All the headlines ran with, killer had a sex addiction. Killer says he wasn't motivated by Asian hate. You cannot separate the fact that he had a sex addiction with Asian women. That is why you can't separate race from his violent actions. He specifically sought after Asian women. And where does that come from? It comes from a long history of objectifying, fetishizing, hypersexualizing Asian women. So when people started finding out about our marriage, this our interracial marriage, the same racist, derogatory, dehumanizing language was used to describe me. And a lot of people use that opportunity to say, oh, how opportunistic of the two of them. They are just so attention hungry. They just want this validation, whatever they say. There's a whole host of things that people have said in response to the news of our marriage. Well, we didn't want to be public with this, honestly. Neither of us. We delayed and delayed as much as we could, and then more people started finding out and it started spreading really quickly. So we knew either we control the narrative or either we put out in our words what our elopement meant to us, or other people would define that for us. And so that's how Vogue came to be.
I've seen you active on Twitter, and you are also calling out people for the words they use, particularly the word fling. Tell me about that experience.
Oof. So, you know, I made a very deliberate choice not to be silent about this. It has resulted in garnering a few new enemies, that's for sure. But I don't care. I really don't care. If this means that suddenly they're being challenged on something that they have never been challenged on before, then good. And if this means that this is starting a really vibrant conversation on race and sex and femininity and professionalism, then I think I've done my job here. You know, I challenged a few people, a few famous, infamous people in Vancouver to examine their own history using pejorative, dismissive language when describing Asian women. And one person in particular, as recently as just, you know, a day or even a few hours after our announcement came out, tied the word fling to the word Chinese. He was describing a previous relationship of Gregor's and said that she was a fling, a relationship of 3 years. And I just had enough. This is an accomplished Chinese Canadian woman he was describing. And then it turned, and talk about someone who was reluctant to constructive feedback. When I pressed him on this issue, and I was very intentional about this. I never called him a racist. I said his language was problematic. He pushed back and said, I'm going to sue you, cease and desist. This is defamatory. I thought that was just a perfect illustration of what has happened to Asian women who have spoken out.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I find it interesting there that you spoke about you were very deliberate not to call someone a racist. And I think racialized communities, people often do that because they know how emotional that makes someone and they're worried about that backlash. I do it myself. You know, in actuality, I believe everyone's racist. That's how we've been raised. That's what systemic racism means. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to call somebody out for being racist because I'm scared of what that means for me and for the conversation.
Right. it's so triggering, isn't it? And people think, I'm not racist. I don't hate Asian people. I don't hate Black people. I don't hate Indigenous people. That's not the problem. It's your implicit bias. And that often gets conflated with, well, then that's not, you can't conflate implicit bias or subconscious bias with racism. But here's where the conversation around this becomes more complex and nuanced. When you have microaggressions against a community, and it could be anything from making fun of the way they look, the way they smell, the way they dress, the way they talk, to being dismissive of them, all of that has a cumulative effect that is under the umbrella of racism. We've done a disservice in this conversation by believing that racism is something overt and something heinous. We all have racist attitudes, and very harmful racist attitudes. And you know what? It takes a second to be called out on it and say to yourself, oh my God, well, I can't believe that I've been a part of this, and I'm going to do everything that I can to change it. It takes a second.
One of the things I think about too is, you know, I don't know for me if it's like being part of a certain generation, but I feel like there are a lot more people who are now taking the stand and talking about these issues. It's okay to talk about these issues. But I remember back when 9/11 happened, and in the United States, there were attacks on Sikh men. Both my brothers, my dad wear turbans. And in the days after 9/11, I called my brothers and I said, don't go out into public unless you absolutely have to. If you do go out in public, do not smile. Don't laugh at anything. Don't tell jokes. Just do what you need to and go back home, because I was so scared. But I didn't think to actually raise that concern anywhere else but with my family, because I was concerned for their safety. I'm just wondering, you know, with what's happening in Atlanta and, you know, San Francisco and New York, all these images we're seeing, you know, what's that like for you? Are you feeling any of that?
Yeah. Did you see the video of the 65-year-old Asian woman who was beaten in New York, and the security guards just stood there, watched, and even closed the door after she was beaten?
I mean, I have tears in my eyes thinking about it right now.
When I saw that, I called my mother, because it was reported that this woman was on her way to church in New York. And my mother goes to church 3 days a week, and she lives in New Jersey. I called her and I said, do not go out. I don't want you walking. I want you to cover your face. If you do have to go somewhere, I want no one to be able to see that you're an Asian woman, in fear that she would get targeted. I can't believe we are at the point right now where we have to fear for the lives of our mothers and our grandmothers and our grandfathers because of this deep hatred against a race. I'm glad you brought this up, because I do believe where we go from here is to have meaningful conversations about casual racism.
Asians living in Canada and the U.S. have also been subject to the model minority myth that they've assimilated, won't fight back, and are successful. On the surface, you know, it seems okay, but dig a little bit deeper and there are some dangerous assumptions. They're still, in many instances, made to feel like the other. Many can't break through the so-called bamboo ceiling because they're not seen as, quote unquote, tough enough for leadership. And it can also make it seem like racism is less insidious than it is. Add to that the great diversity in Asian populations. Now, not everyone is successful in that community, and many, especially seniors, are living in poverty. I hope you'll keep this conversation going. I'm Binder Sajjan. Thank you for listening to Lady at the Ledge. Until next time, bye.